Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM, HD1, Evanston, Chicago. I'm Evelyn Wan, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, how the L came to be. The history behind Wilmette Theater. What are Northwestern students' ins and outs for the new year? And a poetry segment on time. Those stories and more coming up. From Northwestern University, this is WNUR News at 6. Ever climb aboard the L in Chicago and wonder how the system ended up like this? In a rerun from 2024, Allison Rauch took a dive through this transit tale.
There's no question that Chicago's elevated rail system keeps the city and suburbs moving. But what are some of the challenges that prevent it from operating at its best? What are the worst parts about riding the L, whether you rely on it or you're just taking it for a one-off trip? Do these issues affect all riders or just some? And if so, who? I'm Allison Rauch, and this is Elevating, a new podcast series from WNUR News. Episode 3, How Can the L Be Better? It's safe to say that riding the L isn't the most glamorous transportation experience. One big issue the L has faced in recent years is long waits for trains, in some cases for trains that never arrive.
But a lot of people are shifting to Metra, even for trips in the city or Evanston. So people maybe used to take the Red Line to come downtown, now they're taking Metra.
That's Joseph Schwederman again, professor of transportation at DePaul University and director of the Chaddock Institute for Metropolitan Development. He mentioned how long wait times for trains are prompting some riders to stop using the L entirely.
There's been booming ridership in some of the stops for Metro in the city and close-in suburbs, people that previously taken the CTAs. A lot of people are migrating to that because you have a predictable, high-quality riding experience.
Why is that switch bad for the CTA?
So in Chicago metropolitan area, there's commuter rail, there's rail rapid transit, and there's bus service. And those services are delivered by three different organizations.
That's Joseph Schoeffer again, emeritus professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. He outlined that while the CTA controls the elevated rail system, Metra is its own organization. So if riders are migrating to Metro because they want a more reliable riding experience, that hurts the CTA's bottom line. And as always, money is the sticking factor. Fewer funds often means fewer improvements. Schwederman elaborated on why on-time transit isn't as big a priority in the United States as it is in, say, Europe.
Why don't we have European-style systems? Because voters don't care enough about it to make, like, if our governor would be worried about CTA delays, things get fixed real quick. But he doesn't feel that pressure. Whereas in Europe, it's like in Germany, a big crisis because the trains are only 80% on time and the chancellor of Germany is embarrassed about it. It's promising fixes. And here it's like, it's just the way life is.
Schoeffer also discussed the difference between American and European transportation. He noted that while European cities often have higher densities, which helps with transit, they're also willing to pay more for better services.
You've heard the phrase European socialism. I don't want European socialism in the United States. It's a dog whistle for high taxes. And what they don't say is it's also a dog whistle for better service, more service. People there have made a different decision a long ago to accept higher taxation and demand better service, and that's what they get. So if you look at the transit services in Europe, they're heavily subsidized like they are here, probably more heavily subsidized. People always look at Europe and say, why can't we have high-speed rail in the United States? And the answer is you're not willing to pay for it.
In the American public transportation context, with fewer subsidies, ridership matters. It becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. Problems exist due to lack of funds, people stop riding, further depleting funds, and preventing problem solving. To be clear, it shouldn't be just the rider's responsibility to fix the problems with the trains. But when you've been waiting nearly 20 minutes at Howard for a Red Line train downtown, it's easy to get frustrated.
If you don't have enough operators to run your trains and buses, that service doesn't go out. So instead of 10 trains an hour, you're seeing 8 trains an hour. that by definition means that somebody's waiting on a platform longer than they should be.
That's Brian Steele again, Vice President of Communications for the CTA. You might remember back in episode one how Steele mentioned that the CTA has had a hard time hiring since the pandemic, especially for their rail positions.
Rail hiring has been a challenge for a couple reasons. Prime among them is a lot of the rail positions, particularly that of rail operator, is one of our most complex positions that require the most training. A lot of people have asked us, why don't you just hire rail operators off the street? And our answer is, our focus, first and foremost, is on safety. We want individuals who have some working experience with a railroad. And it's why CTA only hires rail operators from the position that I mentioned a moment ago called rail flagger.
Rail flaggers are the people who signal trains to help regulate flow around construction zones.
Best thing about being a rail flagger is you learn railroading 101. Mm. You learn how railroads operate. You learn communications techniques. You learn about the infrastructure and how some of the important infrastructure like switches operate. But perhaps most importantly, you learn safety. Safety has been and will always be our number one focus. And you go through some extensive training to even get on the tracks. And then you get more training experience as you're working as a flagger. That helps you become a good rail operator.
These flaggers ideally move on to becoming rail operators, but Steele says that progression can take a while.
It's a pretty long ramp up to fill these positions, but we feel that that's very appropriate given the safety sensitivity of these positions and given the fact that these men and women are operating 400-ton trains with literally hundreds of people on them. We will not compromise safety for the sake of expediency as it relates to hiring.
Thus, if there's not enough people to run the trains, there simply won't be as many trains arriving. It's admirable that the CTA emphasizes safety as a core value. But on the flip side, Steele's framing makes it seem like there's no way to improve wait times.
We put in place a system process several months ago called Optimize Service, basically making the level of service match the workforce that we have available. Now, what is that going to mean? It's going to mean two things. Number one, it's going to mean that you're waiting longer for your train. No question about that. But we were providing what customers were really telling us back in 2021 and 2022 is they wanted consistent, reliable service. Because what a lot of people are experiencing was they'd get up on a platform and there'd be one train that came in 5 minutes. Next train was 20 minutes. Next train was 12 minutes. Next train was 15 minutes. Next train was 22 minutes, right? So it was kind of all over the place. So the optimized schedule was designed to provide more consistent, reliable service. So even though the individual wait time in most cases was a little bit longer, it's service that you could rely on.
This optimized service looks more like a metro schedule. Fewer trains, but at more predictable times. But it all depends on the customer's expectations. Are you more content to wait 20 minutes for a metro train that you know will arrive because you know that's how metro works? Or do you get on a CTA platform expecting a train to arrive shortly and are disappointed? Another big issue surrounding current L operations is safety, both in terms of accessibility and in providing a comfortable riding experience. Steele mentioned the focus on safety in terms of rail operations, but something like accessibility is much harder for them to control.
The CTA is what's known as a legacy system. We're one of the oldest systems in the country. The CTA was the first large transit agency in the country to make a commitment to 100% station accessibility. President Carter unveiled a plan in 2018 called ASAP.
That would be President Dorval L. Carter of the Chicago Transit Authority. The All Stations Accessibility Program aims to make 42 remaining non-accessible rail stations vertically accessible by 2038. So far, funding has been secured for 14 currently inaccessible stations. Once this construction is complete, which could take a while, 81% of all L stations should be vertically accessible per the CTA's website.
Elevators are the primary accessibility component that we install at stations. they take up a lot of space. You have to have space for those big towers. Where do you find that space when you've got a 100-plus-year-old station surrounded by 100-plus-year-old buildings?
You might remember from episode 2 how we discussed that buses can provide more dense coverage than elevated rail. And here's another advantage. All CTA buses are currently 100% accessible to those who require step-free access. Improving accessibility on the L will take a while, but it's encouraging that the CTA is actively working on a plan. But what about issues such as ridership safety? Between January and November 2023, there were about 4.7 violent crimes on the L for every 1 million rides, per the Chicago Tribune. That's down from 6.2 crimes per million rides during a similar period the previous year. Nonviolent crimes have also dropped. This is all encouraging, but there's always room for improvement. Schwederman mentioned a few ideas.
There's talk about like an app where you can report problems instantly when they occur to be solved. There's more stronger police presence, but also a lot of talk about having ambassadors on the train that just sort of walk around and check things.
Increased police presence on trains, of course, comes with important caveats about avoiding discrimination against marginalized riders. One of the best things about riding the L is that it is for every member of the community. Therefore, police presence or not, it is crucial that more privileged riders avoid forming biases against less privileged riders. These people can include those experiencing houselessness, those soliciting money from other riders, or those suffering from physical or mental illnesses. While many of these riders are not disruptive, some are, whether they mean to be or not. This can cause other riders to avoid the L.
That's where the bus has been pretty favorable. With the bus, you have a gatekeeper, and that's the bus driver. So maybe one in the morning, but once you're on the bus, you feel pretty safe because the bus driver is not going to let somebody come through and panhandle, you know. And so it's interesting how post-pandemic, the bus is taking on, there's increased interest in the bus.
It's also important to note that the public nature of public transportation can disproportionately affect some riders who may face increased danger simply by being in public, especially late at night. This can include some of the less privileged riders I mentioned earlier, but more generally, this can also apply to women and LGBTQ+ people, especially those who are non-white.
You have to be realistic about whether a woman traveling alone at 1 in the morning will be comfortable taking the L, so we may need creative options for those populations too.
Some of these issues have to do with Chicago as a city or even society at large. They're not necessarily exclusive to the L. But again, public transportation should be for everyone. That means that everyone deserves to feel comfortable riding the train. Next episode will be our final episode. We'll talk more about how the L is currently evolving and how it might change in the future.
In general, there's no way to separate it from politics. It's always going to have a political aspect.
We need a big idea to make all the connections work better.
What that future looks like, that future is being written now.
There's some really nasty, hard decisions to be made about whether you want to keep that public transit system in it, in what form do you want to do it.
Thanks for listening to Elevating. For WNUR News, I'm Allison Rauch.
After over 100 years, the historic Wilmette Theater is still engaging audiences through their community-based programming. In a rerun from 2024, Amelia Donhauser has the story.
The Wilmette Theater, after 100 years of operation, is still engaging audiences in the community through unique forms of art programming, entertainment, and givebacks. Despite their efforts, they still face funding challenges, like most local theaters across the country.
And we've had our ups and downs with, you know, equipment breaking or the heat going out or, you know, certain things like that. So that's been, you know, we have our challenges.
That was Amy Falkowski, a Wilmette resident and program director at the theater, who started in 2021 in the midst of the pandemic and revamped the theater. She says starting in the middle of the pandemic was particularly challenging.
So when we first opened, it was like, yay, you're here. And then it was like, like, oh, wait, but now we have to kind of close down a little bit, or now everyone has to wear masks and show COVID tests or show that they were vaccinated. So that was really hard.
Falkowski, who initially wanted to be a member of the board of directors at the theater, saw the program director job and realized it made sense, she says, considering her background and interests in the arts.
When I was in graduate school, I had taken history of film, and when I was in undergraduate school, I had worked in a small independent movie theater for 2 out of the 4 years that I was there. So I'd always had an interest in movies, and especially like independent movies.
She also said she noticed a shift in new businesses in downtown Wilmette and wanted to preserve the theater.
I saw that change was happening, and I wanted to make sure that the theater wasn't part of the demolition, but was a part of the sort of renaissance.
She believes that they continue to grow and gain more support in the community each year because of their programming.
So we do the movies, and so we try to do a balance between family fun movies and stuff like that, and then, you know, more of the independent and foreign films and things like that. But then also we do live comedy, live bands, we do a story slam.
Even though the theater is a nonprofit, Falkowski still wants to give back and engage the community.
We do a lot of like children's rentals and other children's activities. We work closely with the village to do things like the historic months and stuff like that. So we just did Hispanic Heritage Month, where we put on a free movie for that. And we'll do like Women's History Month, Black History Month, Asian American Pacific Islander Month, and all those kinds of things. So
last winter, she says they ran an event called Rock for Socks, where the entry fee to the concert was a bundle of socks.
So those were donated to the unhoused who needed, you know, socks. And I think we gathered like, 3,500 socks or something like that.
Yet, she says receiving funding for programming and renovations for the theater can be challenging.
It's hard. It's hard to run a nonprofit in an affluent part of the city or part of the country, and try to convince, you know, grants and stuff like that, that we need that money. It's like, well, you live in a wealthy community. Shouldn't they give you money? And we're like, yeah, they should, you know, but like, so should you.
Right now, she says they're fundraising to replace the original marquee.
Our marquee is crazy old, and, you know, the letters fall off, and so we would like to have, you know, to be able to restore our original marquee, and that takes money.
Falkowski says what makes a local theater special is how it's community-oriented, and kids can learn their independence there, unlike a big chain theater.
So this is a, you know, a community place. They can come and tell me their order, you know, and it's not a big scary, you know, megaplex or something like that. They can ride their bikes up to the theater and park their bikes up front. It's small. The kids can come in on their own. Their parents can drop them off, and they're here by themselves. I mean, we're not babysitters by any means, but it's very, like, cozy and comfy and safe in that regard.
Sam Neamy, who saw an afternoon showing of the new, highly anticipated film Saturday Night in one of their two theaters, says watching the movie there made her experience even better.
I thought it was a great movie. I had a lot of fun watching it. I think the environment definitely had a lot to do with that, too.
Unique events and the history of the theater is what makes it special for Falkowski.
You can't go to one of the big box places and see live comedy or see a local band. That's just not going to happen. It's important. Yeah, and it's also a part of the history, you know?
Neamy says that it was her first time at the theater, but is already looking forward to more programming and going again.
If you haven't been to the Wilmette Theater, you should definitely go. It's adorable. And the marquee outside the front is just, like, iconic.
For WNUR News, I'm Amelia Donhauser.
Now that it is finally 2026, Sahana Unni went around campus asking students about their ins and outs for the new year.
After a long year of getting brain rotted on TikTok and conversing with ChatGPT, Northwestern students are ready to leave behind their 2025 selves and enter a new era. I went around campus to figure out what students' 2026 ins and outs are.
What are your 2026 ins and outs?
For my ins are definitely moral philosophy and kind of a like an add-on to that, discussing class content after class, kind of like academic weapon type B.
In is chalance, like being chalant, which I guess leads to outs, which is nonchalance. We're done with that.
Walking backwards is in.
North Campus is out. South Campus is in.
Mopeds are out.
My 2026 in is definitely orange blush and weird socks.
But it's more than just weird socks and abolishing mopeds. some students are eager to use their ins and outs to make lifestyle changes.
My 2026 ins are getting more sleep, eating more, traveling more, and my outs are procrastinating.
I'm trying to leave behind my indecisiveness, and I'm going to leave behind like canceling plans last minute because I keep doing that. I think I'm going to work on improving my sleep schedule.
One thing I want out from 2025 is sleeping too little hours.
My out is staying up past midnight on a school night.
Northwestern itself is a subject of this year's ins and outs.
My outs are Franz, low-key. Controversial, but it really has stopped hitting since first quarter. And friends kissing their friends. That's another out.
My in for 2026 is Allison dining hall food, and my out is Four Nose Pizza.
But more than anything, students are aspiring to change their plugged-in habits.
My outs are Instagram.
My outs? Instagram, Snapchat, YouTube, GroupMe, MySpace.
Out is my phone. Goodbye, phone. Like, you are horrible to me.
My 2026 out is 6'7".
My out is 6'7". And my 2026 in is gonna be dabbing. I think it's making a 10-year comeback.
My 2026 out is ChatGPT.
My 2026 in is going to be spending time in nature.
So here's to a year of hoping for Orange Blush, Allison Dining Hall, nature, and ins that will stay in and outs that will hopefully be left behind in 2025. For WNUR News, Sahana Uni.
On this week's episode of Well-Versed, Ilse von Heimberg reads poetry that handles the concept of time.
This is Well-Versed, WNUR's poetry segment, where you'll hear timely readings to help you relax, reflect, and reconnect. I'm Ilse von Heimberg. Today, we're going to be exploring the concept of time, how we measure it, how it moves too fast, how it moves too slow. As we enter a new year, time can be a source of anxiety for some and impatience for others. The following poems show that these emotions are only human. This first poem is a recent one by Maggie Smith, who is most known for her 2016 poem, Good Bones. Smith's forthcoming poetry book, A Suit or a Suitcase, will be released in March of this year. This is Document by Maggie Smith. The day is winter bright. I blink against it. Each time the sun glints in my eyes, each time I close my lids and let them go orange and freckled with light, my mind files it into a folder that contains every other time it's happened before. Folders nested inside folders going back, I imagine, to one morning standing in my crib waiting for my mother to reach down and lift me out, the sun keeping me company until her arms appeared. In the file, sun, sun 2, sun 3, sun 75, Sun 700. Each a document I can return to and open, even revising old experience with new thinking. As if the eye has its own memory. Not the mind's eye, but the eye's mind. Cataloging material it claims as its own. Cataloging as long as I live. Sun 7000. Sun final. Sun final revised. Sun final final. Our next poem comes from Stanley Moss, the author of 17 books of poems and famous for his exploration of mythical and religious figures in his poetry. This is New Word by Stanley Moss. A single word, first last, deserves to be a word in life's dictionary. Remember the first last. He's first, late, coming soon. That word has a day and night in it, but no death. Death is a state of disappearance. In German, Tod means death. Wash away the final D, too becomes part of an infinitive. All the English words I've found have grown in the sometimes lonely dictionary garden. A useful word grows, pollinates in the OED. I thumb through a little. I find I see with my eyes a sea I can sail across. Changing the spelling changes the history. See and see become yes in Spanish and Italian. Primero y último, first and last, are too vowelish to be words in English. They work perfectly in opera. In various languages, give light and darkness have beautiful meanings and references. I add a new word, first last, to a dictionary. Life, that is a theater of languages, a part of speech. A word must be an actor and an audience. Brecht made the audience part of the play. Who's there? You ask a soldier and a ghost. I pickpocket the last line. Each of us says, let the soldier shoot. If there is a curtain, it falls. Outside the theater, I call for a taxi. I wait, I wait, I wait. I believe the first last taxi is coming. Everything that lives is first last. I see one pigeon, but all of the trees are out of sight. Our last poem is Pencil Letter by the Russian poet Irina Radishinskaya, who served as Northwestern's poet-in-residence from 1987 to 1989. I know it won't be received or sent. The page will be in shreds as soon as I have scribbled it. Later, sometime. You've grown used to it, reading between the lines that never reached you, understanding everything. On the tiny sheet, not making haste, I find room for the night. What's the hurry when the hour that's passed is all part of the same time, the same unknown term? The word stirs under my hand, like a starling, a rustle, a movement of eyelashes. Everything's fine, but don't come into my dream yet. In a little while, I will tie my sadness into a knot, throw my head back, and on my lips there'll be a seal, a smile, my prince, although from afar. Can you feel the warmth of my hand passing through your hair, over your hollow cheek? December winds have blown on your face. How thin you are. Stay in my dream. Open the window. The pillow is hot. Footsteps at the door and a bell tolling in the tower. 2, 3. Remember, you and I never said goodbye. It doesn't matter. 4 o'clock. That's it. How heavily it tolls. Thank you for taking the time to be here. This winter, keep in mind that the passage of time is a constant, so it will be spring again soon. For WNUR News, I'm Ilse von Heiberg.
Now, for a brief look at the forecast. This weekend is looking like a cloudy and chilly one. On Saturday, it's mostly cloudy with a little bit of sun, with a high of 19 and a low of 10. On Sunday, clouds will keep covering the skies, and we're expecting snow showers in the afternoon. Taking a look into the headlines in Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. The Starbucks on Dempster will be reopening next week after closing mid-November because of a labor strike. Unionized workers walked out on November 13 after struggling with labor negotiations with the company. Workers have been negotiating with the company since April 2024 over staffing levels and pay. The Chicago Bears revealed an Iceman sculpture of quarterback Caleb Williams at the Merchandise Marts Plaza. The sculpture comes in anticipation of the division round playoff game between the Chicago Bears and the Los Angeles Rams on Sunday. The Trump administration announced that it would delay plans to hold back pay and force collections for student loan borrowers. In Australia, social media platforms have removed access to 4.7 million accounts used by children after the new law in December, where the government enacted a law prohibiting those under 16 from having social media accounts. The law came after fears of the negative effects of social media on children. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 893. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, wnurnews.org. That's wnurnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Gabe Shumway, and our reporters are Allison Rauch, Amelia Donhauser, Sahana Uni, and Ilse von Heinberg. I'm Evelyn Wan. Catch our next newscast Monday, January 19th. Now, back to scheduled programming.